Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for $1, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for $1 wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
This is Dmitry Samarov from Chicago, Illinois, and I love listening to Vish Khanna's Creative Control because whether he's talking to a favorite musician or actor of mine or someone I've never heard of, it's as if he's introducing me to a new friend. And the way things are going, couldn't you use a new friend? Listen now.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Ian MacKay is a musician, songwriter, and producer who co-founded Discord Records, which is based in Washington, D.C. Well known for his role in bands like the Teen Idols, Minor Threat, Embrace, Fugazi, and the Evens, MacKay recently formed Kariki, a new band with Amy Farina and Joe Lally, and they released an excellent self-titled album earlier this year. MacKay also continues to tend to Discord Records, which he has overseen since its inception in December of 1980. Having made note of this 40th anniversary milestone, I contacted Ian about having a chat about Discord's current status, and we wound up covering that, as well as his memories of Fugazi's first show in Guelph in 1989, maps and the importance of taking notes, just generally taking notes, songwriting in Kariki, the Fugazi A to Z podcast, which examines every single song the band has written, the Fugazi live series, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you, who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, and Massey Hall's concert film series, live at MasseyHall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Great Lake Swimmers, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 583rd episode of Creative Control, featuring the thoughtful and talented Ian MacKay, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Ian, it is Friday, November 27th at 1:27 my time. It is lovely to see you and speak with you again. Thank you for this time. For those listening, I always ask my guests where in the world they are. I happen to know this information, but I'm going to ask it nonetheless. Ian, where in the world are you today?
I'm at the Discord House. I'm in the office of Discord House, which is located in Arlington, Virginia, which is just across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C., where I reside.
Nice.
Discord House, actually, on October 1st, so just a couple of months ago, I just marked the 39th year of this house.
Wow.
We moved a bunch of punk kids. You know, we left our houses and moved into Discord on October 1st, 1981. And then we rented for 14 years and I bought it, or 13 years, and I bought it in 1994. I ended up living here for 21 years. I moved out in 2003, at the end of 2003, but I own it and I still work here. I still have all the, you know, the Discord stuff all works. I come out of this house. So
nice. What exactly prompted you to move out of the house? People move on, but what was it exactly?
Well, primarily I think that because Discord House within my and sort of the world I occupy, people who are familiar with my work or in the punk scene or whatever, they quite often are familiar with Discord House. It's a fairly well-known spot. And so quite often when people would come to visit, I would end up sort of giving them a tour, which I enjoy doing. But it was a house that people were aware of, so it was like living in a museum. And I also started to feel like a docent in my own house. So it's strange because you'd be like saying like, oh, well, this, I'd say, oh, that's where, like, that's the room you practice in, or that's the porch where the photo is taken, or, you know, that's the office, whatever it is. But it's also like, it's where I, like, my life happens. And it just, at some point I felt like I probably need to get out of the house. I need to live somewhere else. Although I must say, I love it here. You know, I do love it.
Yeah.
But also Amy and I were, you know, we were together and I think we wanted to sort of just, have our own home. And as opposed to having her move into the house, it seemed like, why not get another house?
Yeah, no, that all makes sense. That makes sense to me. How has your relationship to the city kind of changed? Because you've been there. People know Washington. For me, when I watch the news and Washington, D.C. is in the news, you know, I'm sure that conjures different things for different people. It's a seat of power, of course, as a city. For me, I think, oh, Discord. I think Ian. I think, you know, Fugazi, Minor Threat, whatever. What about you? How has your relationship with just being in D.C. kind of changed, if it has at all? Has it changed, I guess, is my question.
Well, I'm a fifth-generation Washingtonian. I've lived here my entire life. I'm 58. I'll be 59 in April. So it was a very strange nine-month interruption. My father had a fellowship at Stanford University in 1974. So I went to seventh grade at a place called Terman Junior High School in Palo Alto, California.
Oh.
But otherwise, my entire life has been here in this, within like sort of we're in the DC area. Arlington is in Virginia, but I mean, ironically, Arlington used to be part of Washington, but then it was, you know, originally, and then it was given back to Virginia. So it's really nestled right in it is in the district, really. It's in the little diamond that would be the district. But my relationship with D.C., I don't come from government. Like, my family are not government workers. My dad was a newspaper person. Like, he was a writer, and my mom's, they're both writers, and their parents were writers and newspaper people and magazine writers. And I don't really didn't pay much attention. Like, I'm certainly aware of what's going on downtown. But if you grew up in a city like Washington, and I imagine it's the same for, say, Ottawa or any capital city, that it becomes really clear that the government is a giant business, and that, like all businesses, self-preservation is their main aim, about making money and keeping the power and jobs. And that's what goes on here. So I've always had a sort of, I'm ambivalent about the government. I don't live in the federal city. I live in the city. I live in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And of course it's evolved. I mean, I think that for anybody who's lived anywhere for 50 plus years, you know, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Cambridge, Ontario, which is about a half an hour from Guelph, where I lived most of my life in Guelph. To be honest, I thought of you a little bit when my family and I recently moved to Edmonton, Alberta, so right across the country, basically. I thought of you because I associated myself with Guelph, and I told some friends from out of town that I was moving, and they said, man, I can't imagine Guelph without you there. And I was, it was a nice thing to hear, but it kind of got to me, and I thought of you because I think I've talked to you over the years, and you've said, or maybe you've said it to others, I live in Washington, D.C. All these government people come and go. It's a stop in their life. This is our city. This is my city. Right. And and that resonated with me quite a bit. I was conflicted. Like, Guelph felt like my city. Like, not mine in a selfish way, but that I associated myself. All my changes kind of came there. So I asked this question because I wonder, have you ever thought about moving? Were you ever close to leaving and being driven out by all the bullshit that goes on there? Has that ever occurred to you?
Were you driven out?
No. I wasn't. My wife's family is from here. I wasn't.
I figured that.
Yeah.
Here's what I can say about that. No, the answer is, when I first began to tour, like Minor Threat, not so much. In Minor Threat, I was really so focused on what was happening in D.C. And I just, touring was agonizing because you didn't want to miss any shows.
Yeah.
Like early on, the gigs here in Washington, it was unbearable to miss a show. Like a band like Rites of Spring, who, were one of the greatest bands that ever existed live. They were just so amazing. And I think they played like 17 shows maybe, or not many. And I saw all but two, I believe. I think I missed the one in Detroit. They went and played with Sonic Youth up there. I didn't see that show. And then there was another show, and I was in London. I was in England at the time. And I actually called them and said, I'm sorry, I'm not there. So you never wanted to miss a gig. And so touring meant we were in Minor Threat. When you toured, you're missing all these gigs at home, all these really important gigs. Hold on.
Yeah.
Let me stop the noise. Hey, Joe. Hey, good. I'm in the middle of the interview. Can I call you back? Yeah, something quick. All right. I'll call you right back. Bye bye. Joe Lally.
Oh, Joe, I miss Joe. I saw Joe.
Hold on.
I'm trying to think of when I...
That was Joe checking in.
I saw Joe a couple of years ago when Aesthetics played Toronto. Was the last time I saw him. I miss Joe. Yep. I miss live music. I miss seeing Brendan and Joe play. Anyway, sorry. So that's ironic. You were just talking about gigs. So
But then when Fugazi started to tour, it was so amazing. We'd go to a town, I think, God, this town is great. No, I'd love to spend 6 months here, not move there, but spend 6 months. But at some point, I went to so many cities, and there are so many great cities. I didn't have enough 6 months to do that.
Hmm.
Actually, I was just typing up my 1989 journals, in which, by the way, we play our first show in Guelph.
That's right. Aaron Riches.
Yeah.
Aaron Riches and Phil Hunter.
Aaron
they
Riches,
set it up.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. It was, let me see. I think it was on.
Is that the Loft?
It was on.
The Loft in Guelph.
It was September 30th, 1989. It says, I said that this is what I said. We left for Ottawa. I think around 12:30 or 1. It's a boring drive. Toronto was a bit madcap when we passed through, but Guelph is a small college town set away from the main highway. Got a bit lost trying to find the Loft where we're playing. Arrived late and load in. A bunch of the meanest looking skinheads I've seen in a while.
Oh, yeah. Out. Yep.
We go to a Chilean joint to get dinner. Not only does it take forever to get our food, but the restaurant screws up twice my meal, first putting sour cream on it, and then on the replacement burrito, putting cheese on it. So I ended up just giving the burrito to Aaron, who's one of the kids putting on the show. I watched some of the first band, Floor Noise. There's a pen pal of mine, Michael Aline from Kitchener, plays guitar.
Ah.
Go to an Asian joint to get vegetables and eat, and rice to eat, but I'm not feeling very well. Rise are playing when I get back, but I can't concentrate on their set. The Skinheads are hot and bothered by something or other. They demand their money back and all storm off for more foolish pastures. Shades Apart from New Jersey are next. Power Pop, played by pretty cool dudes, said, "I'm not really up for the show, but things go great once we hit the stage. Had another shitty PA, but a really responsive crowd. No problems at all. I broke a few strings. Do some interviews afterwards. Go to Phil's house to sleep. Shades Apart come over and stay as well. Said, we order pizza and talk. The pizza guy tried to charge $57 Canadian for three pies. And he's very pushy about it when we questioned the figure, because it should have been $37 and he knew it. Then it says, turned out the Skinheads got the shit beat out of them by some heavy metal kids in an arcade. Oh, well, what goes around? ..
Wow, that's amazing. So did you, what was the, first of all, nice to hear about Guelph, making me nostalgic. And Aaron and I sort of recently reconnected. And so he was just on the show a little while back. So it was nice. And he texted me all sorts of funny things. But he introduced me to you in Detroit in 1998. At the State Theater with Shellac and Blonde Redhead. And I always remember it because we walked in and you were like the first person we saw, like kind of in the backstage area. And you went, "Hey, you guys the Canadians?" And I was like, "Yes, we are."
Yeah.
It's just kind of funny. Anyway, that is great. What is the occasion for you to type up your diaries there? And do you have notes on all the shows you played, or is that, I'm guessing you do.
No, I don't. When I was in Minor Threat, I kept a very, very, very rudimentary journal about the tours. And then Minor Threat broke up, and I was like, I'm sad that I don't have more. I didn't jot down more things. So then, Cynthia Connolly, who I was going out with at the time, she had given me a journal. So you should write down what you did on your tour. This is 1982. So I wrote it. I did keep that journal. As I said, though, it was really pretty threadbare. Then I started to keep writing my journal more often and really getting to the habit of it. In 1983, I kept a few notes. That was Minor Threat still. 84, I started to really write. Then 85, I was really writing pretty much every day. And I did that pretty consistently into the early 90s. When Fugazi started playing, Embrace never toured, so there wasn't nothing really to write about.
Yeah.
I think we only played 11 shows. But when Fugazi started touring, I really thought, like, I'm going to keep a really dedicated journal about Fugazi. So I actually got a separate journal book, and every gig we played, I wrote extensively about who was at the show, things. I just wrote about my impression to the show. I just thought that would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And, so that was we started playing September of 1987. In the summer of 1988, I went to go see the Rollins Band at the 930 Club. And when I came out of the show, I noticed that the ashtray in my car was open, and someone had been rooting around in my car. And I reached down underneath my seat for my book bag, and it was gone.
Oh, no.
And in my book bag was two journals.
Hmm.
One was my personal journal, which luckily I was using thinner volumes, so I had two books for 1 year as opposed to just one. So this would have been July, I think. So or June of 1988. So I had just started a new journal book. So I only lost like a week. And thankfully the first 6 months were residing in a box in my room. So that journal was gone. I lost a week, but the Fugazi journal was gone, and that had everything in it. So that was pretty disappointing. And I wasn't upset. I just was like, oh man, the person who stole this does not care.
Yeah.
And I spent hours downtown Washington, like 2, 3, 4 in the morning, going to all the trash cans, lifting all the sewer lids. Like I was looking in the sewer, but I never found it. But I just kept a journal and for a while. And I stopped, as I said, at some point it became insane keeping a journal. Especially, I was writing things like I was writing that I was writing. It just started to feel crazy. Like the documentation was starting to get in the way. But I have to say that the bits like that thing, like I just happened to type up that Guelph thing the other day. So it was just funny when you mentioned Guelph. I'm like, oh, I just was writing that. And now, and you can say to me, well, why were you writing it? Well, because I could tell you about it. That's why. That's the reason. That is exactly why I'm. People say, why are you typing this? Are you working on a book? The answer is no, I'm not working on it. It's not for a book. It is because it's a way of, is mitigating the right word? I'm not sure if that's the right word. What is the word I'm looking for? It's a way of, like, I have all these handwritten journals. So in a way, I'm, by typing up the journals, it's giving me an opportunity to kind of, well, it's a resource in a way, but it gives me an opportunity to kind of go through these experiences. I have a pretty good memory to begin with.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting to see where my memories veer away from the way I reported it at the time. It's also interesting to see when I realize, wow, I really, that's the way I remember it. Now, my mom once said to me, you know, she was a very serious journalist. I mean, and I mean keeping journals in that sense. When she died in 2004, she left us 60 years of journals.
Wow.
And then my mother was a phenomenal writer. And her journals they're like books. I mean, they're incredible narratives and great observations. And she's just brilliant. And she used to encourage me to write it down. She'd say, you should write it down because then you don't have to remember it. Is true.
That's true. It is
absolutely true.
Yeah.
The problem and the thing is, here's why it's true, because if you write it down, your brain no longer feels it doesn't have to remember it anymore because you have a record of it somewhere. Now, ironically, and this is the true irony of the situation, when you write something down, you are creating a neural path. So, for instance, some years ago, this is an example of that. Years ago, I went going up to do a talk at University of Connecticut, and I've been to the University of Connecticut many times, certainly driven up the highway up that, you know, I've done making that drive many times.
Yeah.
And I had taken a train to New Haven and rented a car and was driving up the highway. And this is when MapQuest was the program online that you would use to get directions.
Sure.
And I still don't use GPS. We just print the directions out. Now, historically, I would call people to get directions, but people say, well, just get them off the computer. So I just print out the directions and I'm driving up the highway and I had a moment. I remember it was dark. It was a winter. It was in the early evening. It was raining, but I had a sense of dislocation or disorientation that was really, it was weird for me. It was very uncomfortable for me, this feeling. Usually I have a really clear sense of where I am in a general sense. Not like, you know, I just have a sense of where I am in my picture of what's going on that day. And I realized that I had not engaged with the directions at all. I had just printed it out. Now, when I was trying to get to the loft, for instance, I would have called Aaron, you know, and say, how do I get there? And he'd say, go down here, take a right, you know, whatever it is, you know, you get the direction. As you write, you draw, you're actually drawing a map in your brain. Like you have a visualization, at least I should say I do. By printing it out, it skips that altogether. So when you write down the direction, you're actually, in my mind, when I write them down, I'm drawing a path in my brain. So now, when I go somewhere, I'll look up the directions on the computer because nobody knows how to tell you how to get anywhere anymore.
That's true.
But I just write down the directions. And that process of writing it down means that when I'm driving, I'm not beholden to something telling me, you have to slow down and make a right here. I know that the right is coming up. I've already got it. I may not know exactly, but I have a general sense of the path. This is another thing that's kind of interesting on that same front, which is, I think that many people today see themselves as a fixed location in the world moving around them. But I still think in terms of me being a point that moves on a map. Like
right.
I see a map.
Right.
The map isn't moving around me. Like I'm the dot that moves on the map. So
right.
Rights and lefts have a different kind of, but I think because of GPS, I think people really it's harder for them to see themselves on a map. I think they see themselves, they see the map moving around them.
As you're speaking, the corollary I would draw is that I've had a thing in recent years where it used to be if you were, say, upset. Let's the example is you're upset with someone, and in the heat of a moment, you might write them an email to express yourself, or a letter, whatever it is. What I've been doing in recent years is I write the draft of the message, and I store it, and then I think about it, and then odds are I don't send it. I got it out of my system. I wrote it down, or I expressed myself. I know you're talking about navigational information. Do you see a correlation as a songwriter between idea in my head, concept in my head of something I want to express, writing a song? Do you see any correlation between the map analogy you've drawn and the notion of I have something to say or express or that I've been processing, and once I write it down, I've learned something about it, I've learned something about me? Do you have that at all?
Not in the way that I think you're talking about. Music is a very different situation for me. Writing songs, one thing you said which does resonate with me is that once I write a song, I learn something more about the song. But first off, I don't write music at all. I don't read or write music. So that's always tactile. It's like ears and hands.
I guess I was referring more to the lyrics.
The lyrics,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
In recent years, lyrics always come last for me. Almost always. Like 98% always. And
That's different than what you used to do?
I think so. It's hard to say. I don't really remember. I think that there was times where, like in Minor Threat, there was a form that was pretty, I would just sit there and write down, like, they're almost like raps.
Yeah, they are. Like, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I think that, I don't know. What I can say, starting in Fugazi, songwriting shifted where we would just play music, and then Guy or I or Joe would then say, okay, well, I'm trying to put some words on this instrumental. Like all of our songs were instrumentals, really, with then words applied. And that's still kind of the case in Kariki. Like, we have these musical ideas. Like, I write, those things come to me pretty regularly. And I just have lots, you know, there's lots of musical ideas. And I know what the song is about, but I literally cannot put it into words. I mean, literally cannot put it into words.
It's like
I know the song's about. So then to make the song public or to share it with people, I feel like I want to put words on it, but the words that I put on the song aren't necessarily exactly what the song is about. Rather, they have to carry some importance that signifies some kind of something consistent, like an issue or a thought that is somehow as important as whatever the song. But it's too esoteric to even get into. I don't really know how to put it in. This is just my more recent thinking about it, because over the last 15 or 20 years, I mean, I don't know how many songs I've written that never were finished because the words just never showed up. It's just the songs where the words show up. I'm like, okay, like, well, that song can come out now. But the rest of the songs still exist in my back pocket.
Do you mean you'd start a lyrical idea and not see it through? Or do you mean you just didn't put words to instrumental music? When you say it's not finished, I just want to...
It means that, well, in some cases, it's just music that I never figured out what to sing at all.
Yeah.
In some cases, I have a chorus, but I never could get the verses.
Yeah.
Some cases I have verses, but not a chorus. I don't know, but I just never finished. But the thing is, I'm in no hurry. So a song like, for instance, Clean Kill, which is the first song on the Kariki record.
Yeah.
I think that the riff for that song was written in probably 2014.
Is that even? That's Even's era, maybe? Or is
it? Well, it was post Even. Okay. It was after Amy and I played our last like Even show in the fall of 2003. And then we took a break from playing. And then, I mean, we never played any more gigs, but then we started to play with just friends on bass. I was still playing baritone guitar.
Yeah.
And we played with Mark Cisneros, who you might know. He's in this band Hammered Holes.
Yep.
And played in Deathfix, and he's a brilliant musician. So he would come play with us, and Brian Baker played with us once. The idea was just to play music, and mm-hmm. it was interesting to play as a three piece because it was a different kind of conversation than a two piece. But people kept saying, "Boy, shouldn't you be playing music?" I am playing music. I'm just playing in the basement. You know, 2, 3, 4 times a week, we were just playing.
Oh, you're just referring to is in the basement. These weren't necessarily public appearances.
None of them were public. Yeah, right. We didn't play any shows at all until Kariki. Well, it was actually in the beginning. It was just called. It had no name. It was just Ian, Joe, and Amy. We played in 2018.
Yeah.
So it took us 5 years to. Pretty much. I mean, there was one. I think Amy and I did. Maybe in 20. Possibly in 2017, Amy and I did 2 songs at Fort Reno. We did an even song, I think.
Oh.
Yeah, I think we did even song, and we did a Lungfish song, just the 2 of us. But she wasn't drumming; she was just singing.
Oh.
That was cool. But there was no other music. Like, wasn't until we played with Joe in the fall of 2018 that we went back to the stage. But we never stopped playing music. We just always play music. So there's a lot. So a song like Clean Kill, I'm pretty sure that riff and the chorus was started in 2014. So it took me 4 years to get the words sorted out.
You know,
but I'm in no hurry. I don't care.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me. You know.
Yeah. I just want to follow up on something because you mentioned Brian Baker from Minor Threat and you mentioned Joe Lally from Fugazi playing with you and Amy. And it has occurred to me that over the years, I've observed that sometimes when you or members of Fugazi or Minor Threat do anything together, it often makes the news or the music news. Like there's a bit of mania over kernels of information about these things, and it creates like a fair amount of excitement. And I just wonder if you have any perspective on why that seems to occur. Because it's just fascinating to me that you can post a recreation of a Minor Threat photo or, you know, Joe and Brendan are on my show to talk about how Fugazi jams sometimes. And it's like a news day. Like, it's a huge news item. And I wanted your it's so weird.
I guess so, but I have to say, I think that is an indication in my mind of, well, first off, the insatiable maw of the internet.
Yes.
And conversely, the vacuum that exists in terms of what people, the fact that that would be newsworthy always makes me think, wow, people need to find something in their lives.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, like, to me, it's so ephemeral. And I find it's a little weird because it doesn't seem to me, those things, it's not really news. It's just life and people, but for some reason people all get excited for a second. And then I think what happens is it's a charge, and then people try to constantly get that charge back. I don't do social media at all. So I don't have any sense of that. I write you sometimes
to say, hey, did you see the thing? And I know you probably want to insulate yourself maybe even a little bit from some of this shit, but it's a weird product of on-demand culture. That people, right, like every band, any band I want to see, if I demand enough, and like they'll play Coachella, like they'll get back together. Like it's sort of interesting. Yeah. Like we all just expect everything all the time. Like I'm going through with my kids. Like I didn't grow up thinking I could watch anything whenever I wanted. I had to be there, and that's psychologically created patience.
That kind of goes back to the, are you a spot that moves on a map? Are you a spot the map moves around?
Yeah.
And that's sort of it's a similar thing. And just to be clear, I'm not a Luddite, and I'm not a crank about it. I don't think anything's wrong.
Yeah, I know.
Like, you know, I don't think that it's like, and like our kids, yeah, their experience is a different reality than ours.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean there's nothing wrong. It just means that's their reality.
I don't fight it. I only try to relate to it. Like, I'm like, yeah, like my wife is like, they can't be on the, like we're doing virtual school because of the pandemic, right. And she's like, they're on the screens all the time. I'm like, we're on the screens all the time. Like, they're not living a separate life than we're living. Like,
right.
So it's just we're all doing it right now, and maybe we won't. The same way we all.
The other thing I'd like to say about Minor Threat and Discord and all that, is that it's also a bubble.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, though it raises up a little bit of dust now and then, you know, I think it's pretty fair to say that 99.9% of the population of the world never has and never will ever know of me, period, or Discord.
Yeah.
Or in the band I've been in. And they're fine. Like, it doesn't make any difference. And I think that has always been in my life, that knowledge has been, it really helps me. Like, you know, song number one, the chorus is, it's nothing.
Yeah.
And it's because it's nothing. It really is nothing. Like, if you understand that life is an open field, then you can decide what you want life to be. And for me, I think things are important to me, but they're important to me because I can place that value because it's really nothing.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, and I say, you know, if nothing matters, then make it good.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Be kind, be yeah. well, be kind, yeah. and take care of people, yeah. you know, and I always keep that in mind. So I try not, I think one of the problems I see with people who are actively get caught up in the way they're being promoted or all that kind of stuff. I feel like they lose sight of the reality of the situation, which is that it's nothing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I'm with you on it. And I think the pandemic stuff has put a lot of that stuff in perspective for some of us, just like what matters, what doesn't matter, you know, like,
right. Sure.
Yeah. So I recently was asked to appear on this fellow started a podcast called Fugazi A to Z. I don't know if you're familiar with this thing.
I'm familiar with it. I haven't listened to it, but I know about it. Yeah.
So he asked if I would pick a song to talk about, and I said, sure, I'll do it. And so I picked Foreman's Dog as the song I wanted to discuss. And the day of the recording that we were supposed to do the interview, I was like, you know what? I might make some notes on this just so I had a clear, I just want to clarify things. But I randomly, last minute, wrote to Guy and Brendan to say, hey, like, do you have any insights about this song? And it was fascinating what I got back. Yeah. Just the way those two work together and four track things. And, you know, Guy was like, I gave him my essay, my master's thesis analysis of the lyrics. And it was fascinating for him to say, you know what, like, I never tell people what to think about my words. That's not what we do. But you're not totally wrong. Like I mentioned, I don't know if you remember the, do you remember, what is your memory? Sorry, I don't want to do this again, but do you have any memory of that song and maybe what that means to you now? Because we got on this whole, I talked about When We Were Kings, the documentary. I don't know. Did you watch that documentary?
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly where the title came from.
Yeah. So it's just fascinating to unpack a song from 1998 and with those guys and get the insight about how they would. I didn't realize they would. Guy and Brendan spent an afternoon. You know, he told me the story. They four tracked and demoed these songs that became Fugazi songs, which I found fascinating.
I have to say that was a rarity. I mean, Fugazi's writing was really interesting. In the beginning, obviously, it was just me and Joe.
Yeah.
And Joe had played bass a bit, but he hadn't written a lot of stuff. So the beginning of the band, songs like Merchandise and Bad Mouth and Waiting Room and, you know, a lot of those riffs, they're my riffs, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, Joe also started, he started to develop pretty great bass lines, but, you know, they're basically riffs that I had. So then when Brendan started to play with us, he just started playing the song basically that I had written. But then Brendan started to kind of shape the songs because Brendan's an absolutely brilliant musician and he has, you know, a lot of ideas. So, but Guy was not in the band in the beginning.
Yeah.
And then the first song he sang was Break-In. That would have been October of 87, I think, our third or fourth show. And he kind of came on board as a vocalist doing some songs. Hold on.
It's probably Joe.
It's actually Cynthia.
Oh, weird. Everyone we talk about is going to phone. Their ears are burning or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I was writing, you know, I had all these, I kept writing these riffs and then, but Brendan was sort of reshaping them, which was, I was like, wow, I kind of have to get used to that. And then Guy was writing more and more words and he was singing some songs. And then when Guy started playing guitar, it really, like change the way we wrote.
Yeah.
And I remember coming in with some songs and like, oh, here's the song, here's the verse and the chorus. And the band said, well, we're not just going to play. Like, we want to write the song. We want to write the song. So then it actually, in many ways, I stopped bringing in full songs because I realized that we were, as a band, we were going to write together.
Yeah.
Collectively. And yeah. So we would just bring in, we would just have ideas. So you bring in an idea and then you just kind of build on that idea. So that was pretty much the way it went for most of the 90s. And then in 98, Brendan and Guy came in one day with his record. They did Foreman's Dog and Arpeggiator, I think.
My God. One of the greatest songs of I love Arpeggiator. Sorry to interrupt, but I love that song.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Foreman's Dog, Arpeggiator, and Turn into Closed Caption.
Closed Caption, that's right.
Those are the three songs they did. And it was, I mean, those guys always did a lot of recording. Mm. There's so much music they've made together. We had in DC, we had a thing called Fuck Bands, basically, or at least I called it Fuck Bands, but it's like just things we did on the side.
Oh.
And they're kind of joke bands, but also they were cool. And there were some of the songs that ended up, like, I mean, for instance, there was a band that I was involved with called Pea Soup, which was Joey Picuri, the sound man, Fugazi sound man. This is before Fugazi, but Joey, it was like basically a James Brown band.
Oh.
I mean, it was essentially James Brown song practically. And he asked me to play bass. And I remember I went to go play a gig and I said, well, I don't know the songs. Well, here's a practice tape. And I was driving in the car to the gig and I put the tape in to see what, I have no idea what they were doing. And it's just nothing but James Brown songs.
Oh.
So when I got there, I said, oh, you gave me the wrong tape. You gave me a James Brown song. He goes, no, that's your practice tape. So anyway, it was like, so we did some recording. It was basically me and the guys from Scream.
Yeah.
And this band called Velvet Monkeys and just people, the different sort of a crew of people. And we recorded, and one of the tracks we did, it was my riff, would turn in later into Suggestion. Like there's a version. So ideas like that, like there were songs that kind of came through this sort of
the fuck
home
bands.
Recordings.
Yeah, the fuck the bands. Fuck band. Yeah. Right. That's fascinating.
So, but I think in the case of Brendan Guy, they really sat down and crafted those things. And it was heavy because I remember saying to them, they came in, I said, oh, so you know, we'll do this. Because I'm thinking, oh, let's take it apart and rebuild it. And they're like, well, let's try to keep it sort of in the shape. And I was like, oh, all right. Like, it was an evolution in our writing.
Yeah.
But it was, I mean, they're such incredible songs. And
Yeah.
And I think, like, Closed Caption and Foreman's Dog both evolved. But Arpeggiator, or no, each other, it made Closed Caption stayed pretty true to form. But Arpeggiator and Foreman's Dog, I think we developed that. That was like sort of a band. And of course, no matter what, once you start working on it together, you're going to have an influence on it, regardless whether you rearrange or anything.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, Foreman's Dog was it was a tough song for us. It was one we didn't play very often.
Yeah, that's what the host Ian of that podcast said. I looked it up; they barely played it. I'm like, oh. Okay, I didn't realize that, but anyway, that's kind of an aside. I love that record. It was fun to really go in deep on a Fugazi song.
Oh, I like to see your essay or whatever.
I think it's coming out soon. I'll send you a link. The podcast anyway, if you have time. I want to ask you about Discord. You're there now in the house, and I'm just curious. What's up? What's sort of new at Discord these days? I'm also curious about your role in it and how it maybe has evolved since the label started. Your day-to-day role, I suppose. Has it changed much?
Well, the label started 40 years ago, so yes, it's evolved. The four fucking decades the label's been around, yes.
Well, sometimes people have a hands-on role at the beginning. They take a little break. Other people help. I'm asking. I have a sense of it from our emails and various conversations over the years. I'm just wondering.
I think in the beginning, obviously, you know, Jeff and I, in the very beginning, you know, it was Nathan Straitcheck and Jeff and I, you know, were putting records together. And then at some point, it was mostly Jeff and I and other people, Amy Pickering and Cynthia Connolly and Eddie Janney and other people were, I mean, I just in my journals was talking about Brendan Canty coming over. I was paying him $5 an hour or something to fold and insert faith subject to change lyric sheets. We were always making stuff here, making records at, you know, a Discord house, just literally making records.
Yeah.
Like putting records together. And actually in this 1989 journal, I am working all the time, like going to the bank and going to the, you know, what I've referred to over, I love it. I always like, I go to the Federal Express office because pre FedEx, right? It was called Federal Express. And also, I mean, we used to have to, at that time, we were getting records made overseas and they were being shipped by air. And we'd have to go to Dulles Airport and bring them through customs. You know, it was like a 4-hour operation. We had to go pick up like thousands of records and you had to fill out all these forms. It was so much work.
Yeah.
So, a lot of that stuff I don't do anymore. Like we don't also, we just, it's sort of set up now. The way the label is set up now is physically speaking, like I'm at Discord House, which is directly across the street from the Discord office. Discord office is in a basement underneath a 7-Eleven and a dry cleaners.
Oh.
We've got that space 26 years ago.
Okay.
And it's so that's where the distribution, like for distributors and record stores and mail order all go out of there. And production stuff largely is over there. The accounting stuff is over there. I have 4 people who work there at the moment. And that's usually about the size of the crew, 4 or 5 people. And then I'm on this side of the street. And over here, we have the art stuff. We have archive stuff, but also a lot of things like this is part of my job, doing interviews, for instance. I do a lot of interviews.
You've done a lot.
I answer the mail. Like I have a lot of mail. I deal with a lot of the recording stuff. I'm working today. I have work to do upstairs in the archive room. I have to go through, you know, today Don Zantara dropped off this drive, which I'm holding in my hand.
Oh, yeah.
It's a little thumb drive that has a bunch of files that I need to get into the proper folders. And I transfer tapes up there. That's when we did the Fugazi Live series website.
Yeah.
You know, we have a stack of cassette decks upstairs, 3 of them, and then we ran 3 at a time and whap them into a drive. We did the DATs. I'm constantly transferring tapes. It's just an ongoing process. So my work, I don't do mail order. I certainly could do it. I don't do it at this point. I don't do the shipping to stores. I don't do any of that work at the moment.
It's funny you say that because I ordered something a few years ago and I opened up from Discord and I opened it up and there was a message from you.
Hi. Oh, I probably saw your name.
Yeah, that was very sweet. I was like, wow. But it did make me think, is Ian doing this? is he?
I might have been. If a few years ago, there was a period of time where I cover occasionally, so I very well may have been.
Yeah, it was very sweet.
But I'm over there. I mean, when I say it's across the street, I'm talking about literally across the street.
Yeah.
If you come out the front door of Discord and walk straight, you walk, it's, you know, 30 feet across the street and there's the door. You go right in.
Yeah.
So I'm always over there and, you know, we're always talking and it's very much like an active kind of crew of people. I do think there's something to be said for me, it's been important to have an actual label, like an operation, an actual label operation, not just a couple of people with laptops and a deal with somebody else to do the work. Today, for instance, one of the things we were working on, we discovered that we had a return on, we don't sell mini compact discs anymore, CDs, but there's some, you know, people buy them every now and then.
Yeah.
And we discovered that there was a return of the Odds, the last Evens record, the Odds, of about 150 CDs. And as far as we can tell, all of them are defective.
Oh. What's wrong
and
with
they're
them?
The last of the CDs in existence, right? Like, we're not going to make any more of those things. So we've been spot checking them. And it's something I've never encountered before, which is but all of them have some kind of, they've been corrupted. But I don't know how or why. It's not uniform. It's not like every time track 4 messes up, it's you put it on and sometimes it'll track, sometimes it won't. Sometimes it's just stored on one track and not in the other. It doesn't make any sense. Never encountered it before. So we were just discussing. One of the things we're working on today was seeing if we could find a place that would press up. We could do like a short run.
Yeah.
Because it seems a shame to throw away those covers. And also, we're never going to make it again, that CD. So for the people who want them, it would be nice to be able to provide them.
Yeah.
I hate to throw stuff away.
Right.
One thing about Discord, we hate throwing stuff away. Like, we have a record label, we don't want to make trash.
Oh, yeah.
You
no.
know, that's a, yeah. Yeah. So that's a really, so that's, anyway, that's the kind of thing that we work
so
on.
Every,
we work on
it. You're working on, you're just working every day on that stuff.
Yeah.
It's, this pandemic, I talked to lots of people, as you may know, and this pandemic has yielded interesting responses to what I construe as kind of a wrap-up question. I always ask people, you know, what's coming up? What's new? And interestingly, in my conversations, people are using, because they can't tour, in some cases they don't have access to studios, you know, some people are trying to write songs, but a lot of them are saying, I'm finally tending to a backlog of stuff, an archive of materials that I just haven't had a chance to sit down and dig through and focus on. I feel like you are doing some semblance of those things all the time in your practice, like your work.
I mean, that was not a pandemic thing for me. I've been,
that's what I mean. Like this.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell, I'll just tell you in 2007 or 2008 or something. I just sort of was thinking about my life, and I was like, man, I've just been doing this for so long.
Yeah.
And I started thinking, like, maybe I should bust out. Like, maybe it's time to close up shop or something. But then I realized that upon further reflection, that I live a very unusual life compared to many people. Like, I own my own time, and I always basically have owned my own time. And there's no question I've worked hard, and I don't feel like, I don't feel lucky, you know, like in that sense. But I am fortunate in as much as that there are many people who have entrusted me and Discord Records with their music. We're talking about since 1980, December of 1980, people have let us basically release their music, sell records, you know, their records, never use a single contract with any of them ever. And it's never been a problem. They just trusted us. And I realized in thinking about that, I, at this point, though now, and this is natural, like Discord was a label that was created to document a community. A community is made up of people. People are mortal. They die. Therefore, communities die. Therefore, eventually the label dies. That's all seems totally normal to me. So the label, the arc of a label, like in the early 90s, after the Nirvana business happened and everything was selling like crazy, we, you know, we were selling, I mean, Fugazi records were selling hundreds of thousands of records. And now if we sell, you know, 5,000 or something, we're overjoyed. But it is clearly diminishing. Like, it's getting to be less and less. Like, yeah. But I've never been goal-oriented. I've never thought, like, let's make this. I'm not an expander. I never thought, like, more, more, more. I'd never thought. I thought, just do the work that's in front of you. So that's what I do still. So at that moment, I started realizing now more than ever, like, yeah, sure, I could bail out, but that's not really reasonable because these people have entrusted me with their work. So I've realized that I have a custodial responsibility to these people to actually, for as long as there's people that are interested in Discord or interested in these bands, to try to make the music available in one form or another and to tend to it, to be the caretaker that I've been, that I basically signed up to be.
Yeah.
And once I decide that, it really became clear what I needed to do, or how to go about doing it. And one of the things I realized I should do, and this is over a decade ago, was I need to get shit organized. Now, that came from another, I had a friend who died. He was young and, you know, he was not young, but he was in his 30s and did not take very good care of himself. But when he died, a mutual friend had been named executor of his will. And I said, oh, how'd that go? Because our friend was a mess. And he goes, the will was pristine. Everything was accounted for. He said, it was the greatest gift anybody ever gave me.
Yeah.
Because one thing, when you lose a friend, it's another thing to lose a friend than having to be faced with a total mess.
Right. Right.
So when I die, someone's going to have to deal with this stuff. And at the moment, I'm the only person who really knows, like, everything that's in this house. Like, I know why this stuff is here. So I can pull down something off a shelf that's in front of me here or from over here, and I can tell you, you know, like, this roll of stickers was when we were doing DVDs, you know, like
yeah.
whatever, you know, that kind of shit. And I'm the person who knows, like I know what everything is.
You're the brain trust, I guess. Yeah.
When I die, somebody would have to contend with it. And that person, because I'm married to Amy Farina, she would be next of kin. And I thought, I need to get stuff organized so it's not dumping it into her or anybody else's lap. So that those two things really kind of became, there was an affinity between the two ideas. One was to be custodial responsible, have a kind of responsibility to take that kind of, to look after that stuff. And then the other thing was to make sure that my stuff was actually organized. So since then, I've organized 35 years of correspondence. I've organized thousands of flyers and worked with people. And that's just not just me. I work with other people, which is also, frankly, part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love it. I love having these experiences of learning about this stuff. And to some degree, typing up my journals, I don't think of this as, I'm not nostalgic really at all.
Yeah.
Like I'm not nostalgic. I don't miss any of that, anything really. Yeah. It's not like that. It's rather, I know what it is. So I might as well put it down for people. You know, that's all I say. This is what it is.
Yeah.
And I think, and people seem to get something out of it. So I feel like it's fair enough.
Yeah.
Good work. So part of being this custodian thing, I have this responsibility is the label itself has to go as long as it can go. So we have moved away from speculating. Like we're not going to, like maybe this band will, you know, do something. We are just going to stick to really family type things. Or, you know, it's just also younger bands, it's hard. They can't really relate to our way of doing things.
Oh, I see. You know, so there's not as much of a likelihood that you would work with a younger band at this point.
No, because a lot of the younger bands who I think are perfectly, they're good bands, but they, you know, they have managers, which is so bizarre.
Yeah.
And that's not my world. I just don't deal with, I've never had a manager,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I've never had like a hired publicist. I just don't operate like that. So it's all more power to them. But I just think that they come to us and they're like, what, you guys don't what? But we're a punk label. So that's how we operated.
Yeah.
This is a different way of doing things.
Well,
but anyway, this is not what you wanted to do for your interview. You blew it.
No, I did not. This was exactly what I wanted. First of all, I want to say to you that I hope you don't die. That is my number one thing.
I will die.
No,
that's
you're not going to die.
It's for sure. That's part. It's the second most natural thing in life. There's no question about that.
I know.
I'm not scared about it. I'm not worried about it. I'm not planning on it.
Okay.
In the sense that I think it's going to occur soon. I'm just saying straight up, it's inevitable. And I'd rather deal with that kind of the stuff now when I can think about it than later when I can't. That's all.
I just, as a friend, I don't want you to die. I hope you don't die.
Oh,
that's it. That's all I want to say.
I don't want to die. That's not my plan.
Yeah, don't die. Anyway, that's the first thing. Right. Secondly, I know from an earlier conversation we had, you don't generally like talking about things that aren't done. But to wrap up, are there future plans for Discord or for yourself that you would be willing to share? Is there anything coming up that we can sort of tell people about?
No.
Nothing. Totally fine.
There's things that are always working on things. There's always stuff happening. At the moment, everything is so screwed up by the pandemic in terms of pressing. I actually just was talking right now, even repressings, like just trying to repress the first Fugazi vinyl is 6 months behind. We're just waiting. Everything is jammed up.
Yeah.
So all of the new project, everything is just a mess right now.
Yeah.
And it's just pulling teeth in terms of getting records made. So we're running into a real problem because there was an enormous amount of mail order and everything's out, but we can't repress anything. We have so many records on order.
Oh.
And that's just a repressing. So never mind the new ones. Obviously, Amy and Joe and I are, you know, we never stop playing music, so we're working away. We've been writing and trying to, you know, come up with new songs. Lyrics are very slow, but we got a ton of music.
Great, that's awesome.
And so that's good. But I'm, you know, I always just work with what's in front of me. So
yeah,
you know, fair enough. At the moment, that's what I'm doing now. And then you know, there's other things always. You know, there's large, endless projects. I'm still trying to finish the live series. I have 60 more shows to post.
I thought Joe was kind of doing most of that. That's you now?
Joe only did the first 30 CDs.
Oh, okay. The website was
That was largely run out of Discord. Like, we did that. You know, Guy worked on it quite a bit, and this guy Alec Bourgeois, who worked for me at Discord, worked on it. But I'm the main person.
Yeah.
And Joe did the 30 physical CDs, but then he moved to Italy and he was gone for 8 years.
Yep.
So the website is sort of, you know, I think that we launched that in 2011 or 2012. So we've gotten, I think we're up to 830 or 40 shows up now, and we have another 60 to go.
Phenomenal.
And that means there's only I think 150 more to find, if I ever find them. Speaking of which, do you know anybody who recorded the Guelph show?
The Loft show, you mean, or the night?
Yeah. Well, the Loft.
I know, but I downloaded the version you have. Are you looking for a better copy? There is a copy on the live series.
Well, I'm always looking for anybody who knows about stuff, because I think like they can find I always look for people who have recordings of anything, because then quite often they can find other recordings from that year, 89. That's what 89 is our dark year. That's the one that we have very few recordings from.
I'll send a text would you guys have recorded that show yourselves?
Oh, no. We got that one probably from Aaron or Phil.
Okay.
Or someone
that's who I would, that's the only people I would be able to ask.
But, if you know of anybody who has,
yeah,
like we played Toronto, I think we may have, I'm not sure if we have that recording or not. We played at the Riv, maybe Rivoli?
Rivoli, yeah. I wasn't at that show. I saw you guys at the Cool House and the Phoenix, but I wasn't at that Rivoli show. It was a bit ahead of my, I was maybe too young or whatever. But yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm always looking for 80, I'm just putting the word out that I'm looking for 1989 recordings. Those are the shows that I can't find.
Okay.
I'd really like, and I have another, say, 500 images to post.
Yeah, I just
so many photos to put up.
I just posted, because I was looking for something, I found my photos of your show at the, I think it's called the Lost Horizon in Syracuse.
Oh, yeah, in Syracuse, yeah.
I think. So I just found them and took a quick and dirty, I took phone photos of my actual photos, and I posted them on Instagram, and people went like bonkers. They were just so excited to see.
Were they the one that we hadn't posted on the website? They're your photos?
I sent you photos from, first of all, I'm not a photographer. I did my best with like a point.
It doesn't matter, actually. Quite often the photos taken by people who are not photographers are often better.
Yeah.
Let me take a look here.
I haven't looked.
I remember that show was insane.
Yeah. The Rochester show was insane. The Syracuse show was okay. The Syracuse show was not, to my memory, insane. It was great. I enjoyed it. But the Rochester show the next day, I want to say, was bonkers. Like, people went nuts. And you had it out with some people. There were people there from Bath, New York. And you were like, it's great to be in Rochester. Like, no, Bath! And you made a joke.
Oh, yeah.
And then the show got more and more intense. And some of the early albums, like early Fugazi stuff came. Guy lost it. Like, I could tell, like, something shifted. It was different than the night before. Like, the mood was much different. We were all pretty tranquil, I would say, in Syracuse, but Rochester was bonkers. Mosh pits and people being jerks, and I don't...
Was it the Harrow East? Was it that show? With Blonde Redhead, that show?
Yeah, yeah. I saw 5 Fugazi shows in 98, so yeah.
All right. I
don't remember all the venues, but I saw Chicago, Detroit.
Well, yeah, I would like to have the. Do you have those photos?
Yeah, yeah, I can send them to you again. I think I did mail them to you because you sent me.
I'll make sure.
Yeah, I'll send them again. I'll scan them or something.
I know I must have. They might be some of the stuff that I'm sitting on. Hold on a second. Let me take a quick look.
Sure.
Could I have? That's exactly. This is exactly the kind of stuff that I'm working on.
Okay. Like,
I'm just trying to get.
Again, I didn't shoot at anything at Rochester. My last, the Syracuse show, I think that's right. Wait, which one? Maybe I'm wrong. I think it's Syracuse is a smaller club, and Rochester
it was.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Now I can't remember shit. I'll send you scans because I just came across those photos. I can send them again if you want.
If you sent them to me, I don't have them marked, which is very much unlike me.
You sent me a postcard thanking me for all of the stuff I sent. But I will send them.
Right.
I'll send them again. Don't worry, it's fine. They weren't like great. I wasn't expecting much. I still remember. I gave Steve Albini the photos from the Chicago show that, remember the Congress Theater show in 98? I saw Shellac in Vancouver in 99, and I, you know, very meekly was like, I took these photos of your show in Chicago. And he was like, yeah, great. We don't really like carrying around the photos. He was like, we're on tour here, man. Like, people give us stuff. It's kind of a pain. He was nice about it, but, you know, I felt kind of sheepish about giving him these photos. But you, anytime I've ever sent you any archive print newspaper thing I've done about you, you always take the time to send me a nice postcard, and I always,
message. I have a million billion fucking photos. I have so, I love having photos. It's weird. I can't find any photos from you, which is bizarre that I can't find any. I always credit photos.
Yeah.
Did you literally mail?
I snail mail them to you. I'm fairly certain because you sent me a postcard, but it's fine. We can deal.
What year was it?
Like, well, I probably did it. Well, I wouldn't have thought to do it in 1998. I probably did it when we started corresponding sometime this century, but I don't remember. In any case, I'll send them to you.
You send me, or just send me even the pictures from the. If you can, you know, scan them. That's all. I just want to.
Yeah.
It's weird that I can't find them.
No,
it's
scan them. I'll scan them. Don't worry about it. I'll scan them for sure.
Funny. My recollection is that Lost Horizon show was just jammed, and it was like people were just going nuts. It was so.
Well, and then
the Harrow Ballroom show was big. It was bigger, but I don't remember it being as intensive, but maybe I'm thinking about it differently.
Well, I do know from the photos I took that I wasn't being jostled around, and I got up close, and my memory is...
That would probably be Harrow. It's a higher stage. Lost Horizon was low, like as I recall, just smaller.
The photos I took are of a smaller place. I will send them to you. You and I will figure this out together, and it'll be fine. I want to go out on a Kariki song, if you don't mind, because I love that record, and
thanks.
It came out this year, and it seems fitting to me. Is it possible for you, because I don't have it in front of me? By the way, I noticed Eddie Vedder was on the Howard Stern show. Did anyone tell you about this? He had a very prominently displayed copy of
that. That was very, very nice of him.
Yeah, I have it here too, but sorry, do you mind picking a song for us to go out on from the record?
Oh, what song? I don't know. What song do you like?
I knew you were going to do this to me.
Put on Say Yes. I like that, Jim. That's a good song.
Say Yes. Okay. Anything you want to say about it, per se?
No, you didn't ask me to pick a song. You know.
What do you like about it? Why did that one come to mind?
It's a great song. I thought Amy wrote great words, and she sings great on it. It's an unusual song.
Is this the one?
I don't know.
There's some really great drumming, if I might say, on this record. And some very interesting beats that I'm a drummer, and I was like, man, I gotta go down to the basement and try to figure this out. But she's something else.
Yeah, she's something else.
Absolutely. Okay, this is Say Yes by Kariki. Ian, thank you so much for making time for me, and congratulations on 40 years of Discord, and please don't die.
Oh, I'm not planning on dying. And all you got to do, I mean, really, the only trick is just to wake up every day. And that goes for being alive or having a record label for 4 decades.
It's true.
People say like, are you guys celebrating? But no, I mean, we celebrate by working. We just do the work.
I feel similar and from my modest perch. So all this to say, it means a lot to see you and talk to you. Thank you, Ian, and best of luck with everything in the future.
Nice to see you. Good luck. Hope we covered some of the ground you wanted to cover.
We did. We did for sure.
We'll talk again.
The shoulder. is dirtier. Beautiful is blurrier. Beautiful is dirtier. Beautiful is blurrier. Say yeah. The tall man is shoulder, but shoulders do feel so bad. Beautiful is blurrier. Beautiful is dirtier. Beautiful is blurrier. Say yeah. Say no. Say no. Say never. Say yes.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's very nice to have a man I admire greatly and have for most of my life, Ian MacKay. Ian MacKay back on Creative Control. Thank you, Ian, very much for your time. And in this case, Ian appeared on the 583rd episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available everywhere you get your podcasts. All of the companies, Apple, Google, Spotify, all of those things. It's on all of those things. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my regularly scheduled newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can like the Creative Control page on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative or follow me directly at vishkana. You can also follow me on Instagram at vishkana. Actually, I recently, As I'm speaking to you, as you're hearing this, I don't know what recently means to you, but I did, as I'm speaking, recently post some photos from the State Theater show in Detroit where I saw Fugazi. It was on May 9th, 1998. So I scanned some of those photos to send to Ian, as he requested, and then, I posted a few of them. So if you want to see what we were talking about, head over to my Instagram, at @bishkana. Also, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. $6 or more lets you access some exclusive audio content, and it's mostly stuff from my past audio, my audio archives. I've done a lot of interviews over the last 20 years, and I don't want them to be lost to history, so sometimes I share them, and that seems to be the most practical way to do it. Not part of this podcast, but somewhere. They're somewhere. So yeah, $6 or more gets you access to that, and you can cancel anytime or adjust your donation anytime, so consider doing that. There is actually an episode featuring all members of Fugazi giving me advice about my wife and I putting our old Mish Vish interracial morning show, college radio show, on hiatus in anticipation of having our son, so back in 2011. So man, this relationship with Fugazi goes back a long time, and they've always been very kind to me, and it means the world to me. So yeah, it's kind of a fun one. I got them all on the phone individually to give me some advice, Ian included, obviously. So anyway, yeah, patreon.com/creativecontrol if you want to check that out. Thanks again to liveamasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by some excellent Canadian artists.
Also, Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. They all provide in-kind support for this show. Also, my friend Jim Guthrie does something similar, and you can learn more about Jim and his excellent music at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Ian MacKay. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you might consider checking out other episodes in the back catalog. There's obviously a lot. What did I say this was? 583. So there's 582 episodes at your disposal there. So if you want, check it out. Also, feel free to follow or subscribe to the show and keep up with it, because that helps too. If you like what you're hearing and I like you, then it's all going to work out just well. It doesn't matter if I like you. It's a one-sided relationship. Anyway, I'm babbling as I tend to do. Thank you for listening to this and spreading the word about the show, and I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.